Thank you, Sarah. thank you, everybody. Good evening, and it's a great honour to be asked to talk. However, my mission, as I understand it, is to provide a bit of a background to Ron Muick. And therein lies a little bit of a challenge, because I'm not really sure how you prepare for a Ron Muick exhibition. There's really nothing like him. As I was explaining earlier, the closest that, in my experience, the closest work that a New Zealander is likely to have seen to the sculpture of Ron Muick is the American sculptor Dwayne Hansen, there was an exhibition of his work that came through this country in the late 1980s. And they are photorealist in a sense, but quite different from the intention of Ron Muick's work. So really, Ron's work, Muick's work, stands on its own. And so I'm not sure how I can really prepare you for it in any sense, except that perhaps let's talk about portraiture and another medium, and the one which probably we're most familiar with, and that is the painted portrait. So that's what I'd like to do. And as Sarah pointed out, a few years ago, I was approached with the idea of doing a book on painted portraits in New Zealand. And that really gave me the stimulus to sort of find out about the subject, which I'd had a bit of an interest in, but there's nothing like writing a book on a subject to sort of engage with it. And really, you know, you've got a deadline. You've got to suddenly upskill and do all the research and get your manuscript to the publisher so it can be in the shops by Father's Day or Christmas or something like that. So I was really under pressure. But it was great to take these challenges on. But the thing that did, there were one or two things about portraiture that in New Zealand portraiture that did, that I'd had this sort of idea initially that, well, my book was really the first major book on the subject in the country. So that said something, you know, was portraiture, where did it stand in this country? And I'd long suspected that numerically speaking, it was down the list somewhere and well below landscape painting. I think, you know, landscape is sort of the default setting for artists in this country. And so I decided I'd do a little bit of research, not entirely scientific, but I looked through a number of catalogues for exhibitions that were held at the Canterbury Society of Arts, the Academy of Fine Arts in Wellington, and the Auckland Society of Arts over a period from the late 19th century through to the 1950s. And I found on the basis of titles that consistently portraiture was outnumbered by landscape painting by anything from 5 to 10. So for every portrait or figurative painting, there were 5 or 10 landscape paintings, which didn't surprise me, but at least I had some sort of scientific basis to go on. And also, portraiture seemed to be outnumbered by still life painting. So really, it was sort of running third in the list. And that was fairly consistent right through until the 1950s, which was which I'll talk about in greater detail later, a real low point for portraiture in this country. The prediction made in 1840 that painting was dead, it didn't, as a result of the invention of photography. Well, it never quite happened, but one imagined that portraiture might be the first genre to be severely affected. And it seemed that by about 1950, this might be the case. But magically, it revived. But in the meantime, there was another threat to portraiture, and that was the arrival of abstraction. So when you look at the catalogues for exhibitions through the 1950s and 60s, you see a growing number of titles just relating to abstract titles. So portraiture there was sort of running well behind landscape and behind still life and more or less behind abstract themes. So it was sort of fourth. But however, after sort of hitting a low point sometime in the 50s and early 60s, it was revived, and I would suggest that it's never been more vibrant, vital, or relevant. So, and long may it continue. But portraiture is a personal thing, and I was reminded when I was doing the book on portraiture by an Auckland artist who actually trained in Christchurch, Richard McWannell. He said, "Well, you know, portraiture is about our species, for goodness sake, so we should be interested in it." And I'd just like to inject a little bit of personal experience of my own relating to this book. My first job, I went to Elam School of Fine Arts, and I finished in 1972, my first job was at the Canterbury Museum on the display staff. And one of the great benefits of working at the museum then was that the lunchtime I could duck out the back door and then in the back door of the McDougall Art Gallery. And there was all this history of Canterbury art that I'd never seen before. So I was able to sort of, this is all news to an Aucklander, so I was able to spend many lunch hours sort of looking at all this art, which was all entirely new to me. And there was one particular painting that that was sort of glaring at me, and it was this one here, which I was most impressed by, and particularly so when I realised it was painted by Samuel Butler. Now, I had been forced to read Erewhon when I was at school, and I, of course, the English master never told us that he was a painter. So here I was suddenly finding out that this individual, not only a well-known novelist and a writer on many subjects, including Darwinism, came to New Zealand and was a distinguished painter. All you Cantabrians will know the story of Samuel Butler. He's part of the history of Canterbury, but he came out here in the early 1860s, to make his money, which he certainly did. About 4 years later, having established sheep station Mesopotamia, he sold it, doubled his money, went back to England, and he was able to do what he wanted to do, which was to go to art school and learn to paint. Well, he painted this in 1872, but he was frustrated when he went to art school because they tried to school him, upskill him and paint in a more academic manner, which was absolutely foreign to his nature. And so he gave up, basically in disgust. He gave painting away and concentrated on his writing, and later wrote The Way of All Flesh, which I think was published in 1903, the year after his death. But this painting, as I said, it always impressed me. It's sort of direct, unvarnished, very insightful, and there's just something memorable and very, very emotional about it. So when it came to having to decide for a cover for this book, I said to the publishers, well, there's always Samuel Butler, and they, well, yes, it's pretty. So there it was. So I'm pleased that that little experience I had at the McDougall one day sort of led me to getting to know that painting, and there it is there. And subsequently, one of the reviewers of the book said, pointed out that this person had known me for a few years, said that the portrait sort of bore a certain resemblance to the author when he was much younger, and that might be entirely, well, it was, if so, it was entirely coincidental. Anyway, what I would like to do is provide a beg your pardon? It is a self-portrait. What I'd like to do is sort of an overview of painted portraits in New Zealand the last 90 years or thereabouts. And it's a really interesting period. It's sort of been a bit of a roller coaster ride for portraiture, because when that period started, portraiture was on the rise, and coincidentally, it was at this part of the world, Christchurch, which was the main centre for creative cultural activity in New Zealand at that stage, and for painted portraiture as well. And it was during that period that probably one of New Zealand's best-known portraits and one of our most favourite paintings was done. Thereafter, portraiture, as I mentioned earlier, went into a decline a bit, the 40s and 50s, very low point, and then it sort of was revived. So I'm going to track that, those sort of fluctuations in portraiture's fortunes somewhat, and also at the same time what we see is a shifting from Christchurch being the centre of creative activity in New Zealand. That mantle was sort of slowly taken over from Auckland, so by the 40s or 50s it had sort of moved north. So let us start with I've just broken these artists down into sort of groups, and the first one is the expatriates. These are New Zealanders who went overseas for training or to further their career, and they didn't return. And of course, the first one we have here is Francis Hodgkins, a painting that's in the Auckland Art Gallery in 1930. Now, of course, portraits can be of specific people, but in varying degrees of likeness, but they can also be more general. And so we're starting off one with a double portrait here, which is of two bridesmaids. But the interest of the artist here is not presenting the actual particular detail of the bridesmaids, of these young girls, but rather to sort of represent the vulnerability of youth. So it's more about a state at a certain age rather than the individuals. And in a sense, I think The Ron Muick sculptures are more about an emotional stage or a stage in one's life rather than being about a particular individual, because we, in fact, in a lot of the cases in his sculptures, we do not, in fact, most of them, we don't know who the individuals are. So that's starting with Francis Hodgkins. And then another expatriate was Raymond McIntyre, who went to England, and while he had a few preferred models, his interest once again was not in the in the personal details of the model, but he was trying to extract a sort of a sense of universal beauty. Unfortunately, he died at a relatively young age, and so his career was tragically cut short. Back in New Zealand, there are artists who trained overseas and returned, and I guess the best known of them all is Charles F. Goldie, who did a large number of portraits of Maori people. And while these are of particular individuals and probably recognisable and based on photographs in a lot of cases, although he did paint his sitters in his studio, they're more about the notion of a passing race than about the state or the characteristics of an individual. Another New Zealander who went overseas and returned was Edith Collier. This is a painting she did of her brother, who served with the RAF during the First World War. I think it's a very affectionate portrait of a family member. Unfortunately, Edith Collier was a painter of great promise, came back to Whanganui, where her modernist ideas and her training were not really appreciated. Her father did not like the way she painted nudes, and she, being the unmarried woman and sister in the family, had to assume family responsibilities. So really, her career she just did not have those unfortunately those career opportunities. And now, as I mentioned earlier, we're about to see the rise of Canterbury and particularly Christchurch as a centre of portraiture in New Zealand. And there are about four artists in particular who are known at this time. In particular, Mary Tripe, her painting here, Peacocks. And I guess the very title suggests what this is about. This is a very fashionable a young woman, and a lot of the wearing her absolute best. A lot of the paintings from this period are really records of a social type. These are individuals who are presented to the painter. I guess they're commissioned portraits. So we have these records of people. Obviously, you had to pay to have a portrait painted. So they're of a particular type, of a particular social level in Canterbury at that time. Elizabeth Woolwork, her husband was the director, Richard Woolwork, at the Canterbury School of Art. This painting is called Fortune. So this one, we don't know who the subject isn't identified, but I think this one has a more serious intent, and that the very title suggests, and the fact that it was done in 1932 in the depths of depression. So there may be some concern here for the way the world economy or fortune generally is going. Elizabeth Kelly, another one of the Christchurch artists. This is called Blue and Silver. It's a painting of Margaret Heatherly that was done around 1930. Very elegant, self-assured subject in an arabesque form. There is sort of a standard format for these. The sitter is always placed in a chair with the elegant arms and a curved arabesque. Some sumptuous background cloth curtain behind. And, of course, the subject is wearing his or her very best. And we can contrast that. Here's the sort of male equivalent, Archibald Nicol, a portrait of Sir George Harper. This is from 1932. So while Elizabeth Kelly painted the young women in their best, Archibald Nicol seemed to specialise in captains of industry and leaders of the community. It's fine. As it were, upstanding gentlemen, but and a very similar pose with the background and sitting, and but obviously a more sort of more aggressive, more male sort of orientated presentation. Moving to something a little more adventurous, Harry Lindley Richardson, around 1930, this portrait of a Maori boy. Now, this needs to be compared with the sort of paintings that Charles F. Goldie was doing of Maori at the same time. And the very clear distinction is that here we have a sense of the artist engaging with the subject. This is a very contemporary, this is a young boy. There's no sense of nostalgia or reverie. There's no sense of a departing race. This is a young boy who's absolutely caught in the studio by Richardson. So it's a very contemporary and fresh view of a Maori subject. But the painting that Richardson's best known for is this one, Mrs. Thornley of Te Tahi Bay. She was the landlady of the hotel, which we see in the background on the right there, where the Richardson family used to go and stay from Wellington. So she was a local identity, and you certainly get that impression. A bit of a local pioneer who sort of ran the hotel, and there are reports of her climbing up ladders and fixing the roof when it was leaking, and cleaning the gutters and doing various things. So she's a very hard-working individual, and Lindley Richardson, I think, has captured that. However, while this portrait mightn't look so startling to our eyes, it was heavily criticised at the time because there was a sense that what he had done was pasted the actual portrait of her over an aerial or background view of the location, which he may well have done, but it was just not the thing to do in 1931. So we can sort of see how what portrait painters were up against at that time and how much things have changed subsequently. There was a great boost to portraiture and painting in New Zealand in general as a result of what was called the La Trobe scheme, which was a mechanism whereby trained English artists came out to New Zealand to improve the standard of art education in this country. And the best known of those individuals that came out was, of course, Christopher Perkins, and this would be his best-known painting. It's a landscape, I know, but 1931, Taranaki. And here we have an artist sort of engaging with an everyday subject. No one had ever really considered a dairy factory as a suitable subject for treatment, but I guess it sort of often takes an outsider to draw our attention to maybe the overlooked, and in this case he suggested that New Zealand should turn its gaze away from Europe and look to our own images, our own landscape, and things close at hand for our inspiration, which is what he did, and certainly others did so as well. He was also a very fine portrait painter, and this is one that he did in 1933 of Professor G.W. von Zedlitz, who was a German-born individual who came out in the early 1900s as a lecturer at the Victoria University. Unfortunately, he got into trouble, such was the anti-German feeling during the First World War, that he actually lost his job at Victoria University. He was, I think, subsequently reinstated, although it might have been somewhat after the event, but he was a close friend of Perkins, and who painted this portrait, which I think is a very affectionate portrait. It's very very intimate, very sort of moving in and sort of looking down on von Zedlitz, and we can see there's a map of Europe behind him, and just above his head there's a sort of reference. You can see Germany, so there's a little hint of I mean, it's an old trick in portrait paintings to have clues to the sitter, little indications of what their profession is, their interests, their inclinations, and their habits and characteristics. So we can see he smokes, obviously, and has had a connection with Germany. Subsequently, when the painting was finished, von Zedlitz did comment that he thought that Perkins had given him a rather simian look, which is not too complimentary, but I have seen a photo of von Zedlitz, and I would say that he doesn't look too dissimilar to that. So I think, in a sense, that Christopher Perkins was fairly fair in that regard. Another of the La Trobe scheme artists that came out, and in fact the very first of them, was Robert Nettleton Field, R.N. Field, who taught in Dunedin. And in 1931, he painted this painting of Miss Kelsey, who was a colourful individual in Dunedin. Now, this painting goes way beyond the convention of the day for realism, and with its sort of jewel-like prismatic sort of colours. So it was really, really quite revolutionary, capturing the energy of this well-known Dunedin and prominent Dunedin personality. And in addition to a small number of paintings, Field's main contribution really was as an inspiration and a guide and teacher for younger artists, and among them was the young Toss Williston and Colin McCann. In 1934, Britain decided that it had a bit of surplus art, so it would circulate it around the empire. So, and of course, the trouble for New Zealand, living in New Zealand, is we really at that stage didn't get to see original painting. You had to travel to see it. It really didn't come here. So this was something to look forward to. So in 1934, the first Empire Loan exhibition, so-called, came to this country, and it included this painting by William Roberts called The Stockbroker's Clerk. It was painted in 1920, so by the time it came to New Zealand in 1934, it was already 14 years old. But I don't know. This exhibition was shown here in Christchurch. Now, I don't know. I can't find any references to whether Rita Angus ever saw that painting. But one can't help feeling that if she had seen it, it would have made an impression on her. I think any likeness will be apparent probably in the. Not this one, but the next painting or two. This is Rita Angus's self-portrait from 1936 to 7. A very bold presentation of a large sort of protective coat. I can only assume that's Christchurch smog that we see in the upper part of the canvas. And I mean, for a woman to be smoking, of course, that's a very strong statement being made there. And then if we move to, and I think we can see similarity between William Roberts' painting of 1920 and this head of a Maori boy that Rita Angus did in 1938. So as with the Lindley Richardson Maori of about 8 years earlier, we are seeing a Maori subject as on the same level as the artist, being regarded as a subject. There's no sense of nostalgia or the idea of the notion of a passing race, as was Goldie's concern. Rita Angus shared a studio with just jumping ahead of myself there. Another painting which this is by Wyndham Lewis, English artist of T.S. Eliot, 1938. You just wonder whether Rita Angus was familiar with this approach. It seems to me that there are some similarities in style. Rita Angus shared a studio with Leo Benzerman, and they also shared models, and including this. And this is probably the same Maori boy that Rita painted. And here we have Leo Benzerman's pencil profile of it of him from 1938. And another painting by Benzerman, 1937. So his very simple and direct process. So we can sort of see this shift that things are really moving with portraiture. So it's really quite a vibrant sort of area at this stage. And then an altogether different approach was apparent with Toss Williston, his portrait of his wife in 1939. This is a more expressionist approach. At this stage, Williston is probably better known for his landscapes, so his portraits sort of have this monumental quality that's not dissimilar to the approach that he took to landscape. But his wife, I mean, this is 1939, I think there was the prospect that he might have to enlist. The wife, I understand, was pregnant, so there's all this uncertainty, and he's sort of looking to her as the sort of the strong figure in the family. So it's a very, I think, a very strong painting. We're sort of capturing all these sort of concerns, as I guess the nation was in 1939. But The best-known portrait of all to come out of that period, 3 years later, 1942, Rita Angus had been had seen illustrations of portraits by Grant Wood, the American for who's best known for American painting the American Gothic, and also paintings by the Mexican muralist Diego Rivera. So this is Rita Angus's 1942 portrait of Betty Curnow, a very personal portrait of a friend, and it's very biographical. It includes a lot of details. As I mentioned earlier, here we have references to her husband's books. There are family paintings in the background. The chair has a family connection. So it's very full of references, to the extent that this painting later became described by Peter Tomory at the Auckland Art Gallery as more than just a portrait, but in fact a portrait of a generation. And now we look to another little subgroup, which is New Zealand artists who were able to go overseas for experience. And one of those was Evelyn Page. Now, in 1934, the Empire Loan exhibition that came to New Zealand included a portrait or two by Augustus John, who at that stage was probably one of the best-known English portraitists, along with Sir William Orpin. So it was Augustus John that made a big impression on Evelyn Page, and she went to England and saw more work by, she hunted down more work by Augustus John, and in 1937 she painted this portrait of Charles Brash. So it's a very serious and somber painting, and you can see that there was no intention of filling in the detail in the back. It's just been hinted at. But the emphasis is on sort of capturing, I think, the somber nature of the sitter. Another New Zealander, who, in fact, she was Mae Smith. She was born in India. She took up painting in England, then she came to New Zealand, went to Elam, went back to England, and then she returned to New Zealand. And in 1941, she painted this startling painting called Characterization in Colour. It's less, once again, less a portrait of an individual and more, I guess, a sort of a homage to the modern woman. We can see in her right hand she's holding a cigarette, but whereas Rita Angus seemed to be making a point of holding her cigarette, this is sort of, it's almost, you know, natural, as if it's a given that women should be able to smoke. I'm not sure if that upset the locals, but certainly the references to Picasso and Matisse in the background fabric, that was a little too much for one art reviewer when this painting was Auckland Art Reviewer when this painting was first shown in 1941. By comparison, a more conventional approach by an artist overseas, this is Peter McIntyre and his well-known portrait of Sir Bernard Freiburg that he painted in 1943. Now, a watercolour and a masterful capturing of all the scents of dust and smoke and on the battlefield. However, it's not quite as it seems. I understand that McIntyre was... Freiburg was a busy man. He was hard to track down to make a painting of, but McIntyre managed to capture him while he was actually in hospital. So he was sitting up in a hospital bed, so McIntyre was able to do the sort of from the waist up, and I think he had him holding a pair of binoculars in the hospital bed. And so the painting is a little bit of a composite, so it's really not of a particular scene, but it's a pretty good portrait of Freiburg nonetheless. Another New Zealander, not so well known, who went to England in the 40s and now lives in Paris, has done for a number of years, Douglas McDiarmid, who left in 1946. And this is a portrait he painted in 1948 of Constance, who was a friend of the wife of a friend in London. He has described this really as a portrait of a friendship. This was one of the... painted during one of the London winters, so they were particularly cold, smoggy in the late 40s, and Douglas has described how you could actually see the smog coming through the cracks in the walls. But so this is really a celebration of that friendship, and there's a little autobiographical note because up the stairs on the right there's his bedroom, sort of rather forced perspective there, you can see a little bit of furniture. So that's a portrait of a friend, but also inserting something of the artist's own situation at the same time. And another New Zealander who was overseas at that stage, although not quite so far afield, Jan Nigro, an Aucklander, trained at the Elam School of Fine Arts. She went to Australia and painted this. It's called The Red Hat in 1949, and it's in the Auckland Art Gallery collection. This is another rather generalised portrait of nobody in particular, but the main point about this one is that it shows, once again, you know, the need for New Zealanders to get overseas to experience art, real art, overseas art, at first hand. And this Australia was sort of that much ahead of New Zealand at that stage because it had had a tradition of European immigrants to a much greater extent than New Zealand ever had. And so this painting reflects that, Jan Nigro's awareness of European artists such as Rubens, Picasso and Renoir, who've filtered through and ideas have been brought to Australia. So the post-war period, as I mentioned earlier, was a bit of a grim time for portraiture in New Zealand. Not only was it sort of running behind landscape and still life, but there was the arrival of abstraction. However, there was this unusual combination of abstraction and portraiture by Louise Henderson in this portrait of Betty Curnow, painted in 1954. She's used a decorative form of cubism, which really wasn't the point of cubism, because here she's used it sort of to delineate rather than disguise the actual subject. So it's more decorative than anything. But I guess probably the main interest is how the comparison you can make between this and Rita Angus's portrait of Betty Curnow of 12 years earlier. Now, one of the other problems with portraiture is that I think, you know, New Zealanders, we've had a bit of a resistance to it, and maybe we're a self-effacing nation. We don't really like to have pictures of ourselves on the wall. But the other thing is, as I've shown earlier, there is a tradition of commissioned portraits, but of course, while a portrait painter might have to accept commissions in order to make a living or some sort of income out of painting, commissioned portraits can be problematic. I mean, after all, you are being required to present a likeness of somebody. It might be someone you don't know, might be someone you don't like. You may not necessarily have too much freedom to express what you feel about that person. So they can be problematic sort of things.
That's
my cue. Unfortunately, when I had this disc transposed sort of for this talk, somehow one image was missed out. But because it relates to Christchurch, there's no way I can overlook it. So, and I was talking about commissioned portraits. You're probably familiar with one of the main portrait painters in Christchurch in the 40s and 50s, who accepted a lot of commissions, was Bill Sutton, W.A. Sutton. He was probably the modern equivalent of Archibald Nicol, who I showed earlier. So Bill did a lot of portraits, and probably recognised that, you know, there were problems. While he got paid for doing, you know, councillors and mayors and captains of industry, you know, there was a certain restriction. So what he liked to do was also paint contemporaries. And there's this magnificent portrait here of an artist, Bill Colbert, which... this is Bill Colbert, the sculptor, who lives, I think, in France, in London. I think he's from Christchurch. He went to the local art school. A contemporary with Pat Hanley and... Hamish Keith and Quentin McFarlane, all that that year. It's a very, very lively portrait of a young student in his slip-on shoes and jeans. So it's a nice, you know, capturing a youth at a particular point in time. So that's that one. But by comparison, here is a commissioned portrait that Peter McIntyre did, and this was done in 1954. So 20 years on, it's sort of the equivalent to those that Elizabeth Woolwork and Elizabeth Kelly were doing in Christchurch of a young woman, a debutante perhaps, with her finery, So it's a sort of a social record at a particular point in time. Now, we're about to move to a rather different approach to portraiture, and that's Colin McCann, who I mentioned earlier, in terms of being encouraged by R.N. Field. This is a portrait that McCann, who didn't do that many portraits, but this is one he did of his daughter Victoria in 1957. And it suggests a young girl troubled beyond her years. In a way, it's not unlike that famous comment that Picasso made about his portrait of Gertrude Stein. His suggestions were that it didn't look much like her, he said it will, and so it came to pass. And so it has been recognised of this portrait that, in a sense, McCann actually captured something of his daughter. She was troubled, and it was sort of a rather prescient image. Her later state was in a sense, predicted by this portrait. Meanwhile, Rita Angus was still painting, and this is a self-portrait, 1967 to 68, and probably just about the last one she did. A remarkable series of portraits, and of course there was the exhibition that travelled around a year or two ago where we got to see a lot of them, and altogether I think there were about 50 of the portraits by Rita Angus. So, but apart from these sort of highlights, portraiture at this stage is really going through a very rough patch. And then, apart from those artists I mentioned, there really wasn't anything sort of too exciting going on. However, things are about to happen. And I should point out that it wasn't just in New Zealand that portraiture was experiencing difficulties. It was a worldwide thing. And in fact, it has been suggested that really one of the stimuli behind its the revival of the painted portrait in England was in the late 60s when David Hockney started doing his large double portraits. And, of course, immensely popular. They still are. One or two of them are still the most popular paintings in the Tate, I believe. And, of course, they've got a great general appeal to the public and art lovers at large. So that was part, I think, of the revival of the painted portrait. But in 1968, there was a concerted effort in Auckland to do something about portraiture, and the New Vision Gallery, which was run by one Case Hoss, got an exhibition together called Face to Face, where it invited a number of artists to come to sit and draw and paint one another. So, and the results were shown in this exhibition called Face to Face. McCann, this is Gordon H. Brown, the writer, and McCann did a drawing of Gordon in the gallery, and I think at that night he painted this portrait and brought it in the next morning. And I've spoken to one or two people who were actually there when this painting turned up, and it was sort of like one of those landmark events. They realised that portraiture could never be the same again, because what this had sort of done was to sort of reveal the sort of psychological potential of a portrait. It really sort of just pushed it that much further. So this is really one of those sort of groundbreaking images, really, in New Zealand art history, and certainly very, very important as far as our attitude towards portraiture is concerned. But while portraiture was unfashionable, and in fact, probably because it was unfashionable, it was now sort of the thing to perhaps deal with. And a number of young New Zealand artists were now taking it up, and particularly a number of students at Elam, where Colin McCann was their teacher. And one of those was Michael Smither, and this is his portrait, the portrait of his daughter called Sarah with baked beans, 1967. I like the story that, inspired by Sir John Everett Millais' famous painting of the boy, which he sold to the Piers Soap Company, which they re-entitled Bubbles, and I guess Millais made a lot of money out of it, not to mention Piers making a lot of money out of it. Apparently, Smither approached Watties, suggesting that they might like to buy this painting, but apparently they missed the opportunity. They couldn't see the point. So, unfortunately, it didn't happen. I mentioned earlier that W.A. or Bill Sutton was probably the most prominent portrait painter, both of commissions and otherwise, in Christchurch in the 40s and 50s. Well, his Auckland equivalent was Garth Tapper, who was, along with Colin McCann, were lecturers at the Elam School of Fine Arts when I was there. So, and this is Garth Tapper's portrait of his colleague, Colin McCann, in 1969. I mean, it says a lot about McCann, but it's also autobiographical because we have at the top left a figurative painting, which was what Garth Tapper specialised in. At the top right, we have what is obviously part of a McCann painting, and then a waterfall coming down, and then this sort of whole idea sort of coalescing, and then through the artist's hands to the new work, I guess, being produced at the bottom right. But there's a little detail that I quite like, and that's you'll see behind McCann's right arm there. There's a white table, a black piece of paper on it, or black cloth, then a white plate, and there are a couple of black forms on it. Well, that is a reference to when McCann and Tapper were teaching. It was a common trick. First year students, painting students, you were presented with a white table. But there was no black involved. It was always just either white eggs or a white object on a white saucer on a white base. And, of course, the idea was that you didn't have to worry about colour. You're just dealing with light and shade, and you're just... it was an exercise to teach you to sort of relate one form to another, to convert everything to the barest of essentials, and at that stage you weren't worrying about colour. So it does rather amuse me that in order to make a more effective painting out of it, that Tapper has broken his own rules in a way and has inserted black into it, because I can assure you there were never any black backgrounds or black blocks of wood or bases that the Elam students were required to paint. But in a sense, it also relates to McCann's painting, a lot of black and white, that contrast between the light and the dark. So that is a sort of a collegial portrait by one artist of another. But the other thing that was happening at that stage, and another pupil of Colin McCann's at Elam, was Richard Colleen. But with the arrival and awareness of pop art in American England, that suddenly gave artists the license to uplift material and sources from really anywhere, printed sources, magazines. It now meant that you could actually just uplift an image, and you're quite entitled to use it as you saw fit, incorporate it into a painting. And Richard Colleen is well known for lifting images from Time magazine or wherever, really, and incorporating them into his paintings. And what we see here is not a portrait of an individual, although it might be a fairly typical sort of suburbanite, but what it reflects is a return, in a sense, from the landscape to more urban subjects. So in a sense, that's good news for figurative painting and portraiture. So there is a revival going on. And an absolute contemporary of Richard Colleen's at Elam was Ian Scott. I think they were the same year. And this is 1969. It's Don Binney at Tehenga, which is a favourite spot of Don Binney's. I did a lot of paintings there. In fact, the Auckland Art Gallery has a painting called Sun Shall Burn Thee By Day Nor Moon By Night, painted in 1966, and it's actually of Tehenga. So what Ian Scott has done here is combined, I understand, a newspaper photograph of Don Binney and an aerial photograph of Tehenga, and put the two together and created this very convincing and, I think, very affectionate portrait of an artist in his location. And in a sense, it relates to the Harry Lindley Richardson painting of the landlady at Tatahi Bay of 30 or so years earlier, of an individual in their locality, so giving them a rich association. And also, I'm sorry, there's a little bit of an Elam bias here, but another Elam student at that stage was Robin White, and this is a self-portrait in 1968. And I think you can see unmistakably the influence of Colin McCann in that one. And shortly she developed her more recognisable style, and this is Sam Hunt at Parramatta, 1968, the same year as the other one, but it's moved on. And then 3 years on, we go to Jerry at the Pycock Pub. So another young individual, sort of a snapshot of youth culture, which is not a common subject for painters. I guess that's why I was sort of intrigued by the one of Bill Culbert that Bill Sutton did back in 1955. So here, 16 years on, another generation on almost, we have Jerry at the Piecock Pub, 1971. So as I mentioned, there's a little bit of an emphasis on Elam, the sort of Auckland school at this point, and it would be extremely remiss of me not to acknowledge that there were exciting things going on in portraiture in Christchurch here at that very time, because Rudy Gopaz was sort of the, I guess in terms of influence, the equivalent of Colin McCann in Auckland, and at the Canterbury School there were a number of artists who were about to start portraiture, but in a more expressionist sort of manner, and they included Philip Claremont, Tony Thomason, Philip Trustham, and Alan Pearson, who I think was in town very recently, or about now. He's just produced he now lives in Queensland, but he just produced a magnificent book on his expressionist portraits. So it's interesting that this sort of expressionist approach came out of Christchurch compared to the more, I guess, the style epitomised by Robin White and probably more in the tradition of Rita Angus, but really influenced by Colin McCann from Auckland. So these sort of two strands. This painting here is from 1971. So what I'd like to do now, just to round off, is to bring it all up to the present and try and relate it back to Ron Muick somehow. So there are just four paintings to finish off with. And as I mentioned earlier, and I suppose I would say this, but I think portraiture is alive and well, despite all the predictions that it should have died years ago. It has increasing relevance, and I think that's because that far from it being at the mercy of photography or the other modern media, it's actually embraced it. It's actually taken advantage of photography, and there's only one artist I know who doesn't use. He's a portrait painter who doesn't use photographs. What he actually does for records of drapery and things, but not for the actual face. But most artists are quite happy to embrace technology. It's a matter of using it where it's appropriate, and so in a sense, photography and all sort of modern digital means have really assisted the painted portrait, and in fact I think they've made it stronger, it's more diverse, it's richer, and so I hope my four final images will illustrate that point. Gavin Hurley, this is My Sad Captain, 2006. Now Gavin Hurley started off his portrait career painting using school photographs of his contemporaries from his school days. So he was sort of painting these large, rather stylized images of his contemporaries from school. And then he moved on to a little bit of a fixation with Captain Cook. So there have been a lot of paintings that he's done of Cook. But, of course, the few paintings that we know of Cook, you know, in terms of his face, it doesn't bear a lot of resemblance to what we see here. But I guess when we see an image of that sort of hair, we sort of naturally think of Cook. But and this is a connection back to Hurley's school day paintings. And Cook is very helpfully wearing a badge which says Captain. It's in the same mould as at school wearing a milk monitor or prefect, or I guess so. So it's a little bit of a play. Curly's having a little bit of fun, but that is a sort of a modern version of Captain Cook, and he's recently done dealt to people like who's the library in Wellington, the Alexander Turnbull. And in fact, I think they bought the library's actually bought a large, very impressive portrait that Gavin has painted of Alexander Turnbull. Peter Stitchbury, another Auckland artist, better known for his very stylized images of young sort of young women with immaculate sort of blemish-free complexions. These are images that he's lifted out of fashion magazines, or, of course, the internet now means that there's absolutely unlimited resources in terms of imagery. It's all just a mouse click away. So increasingly, artists are able to use that as a resource. So this is a little bit different from Stitchbury's usual portraits, and for that reason, I included it in my book. It's a young boy wearing a military uniform, obviously, and a troubled youth, and I guess it's a little bit of a comment on what lies ahead, predicament, I guess. So perhaps a bit more of an autobiographical portrait than what Peter Stitchbury usually does. Heather Straka, who last year did the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship at Dunedin. And I think Heather's portraits are sort of autobiographical in that she paints from models, but they sort of have to do what she tells them to do. She sets up situations, she's painting emotions and feelings. Once again, it's less about the individual. This painting is called Donor 6, so there's a series of them. So we don't know who it is, and I guess it's not important. And I'm not quite sure what the significance of the donor is, but it's more about Heather's view of the world than an attempt to capture anything personal about this individual. And then finally, as I think I might have mentioned earlier, if there's one artist in New Zealand, one painter, that might bear some sort of resemblance or give us some sort of connection with Ron Muick, it's Martin Ball, the Auckland painter, who specialises in these large sort of billboard-sized portraits. Martin finished at Elam in Auckland in the mid-70s, and since then has specialised in these large paintings, mainly of fellow artists or senior artists. These are sort of homages to artists that he admires. They can be practicing artists or lecturers, include people like Robert Ellis, Stanley Palmer, Dick Frizzell. And in this case, one or two musicians. Because this is Tim Finn, he was hanging around Elam in the early 70s. There were a few Elam students. They were sort of getting together and getting a band going, which subsequently became, of course, Split Enz. So this is another of Martin's sort of interest. So his paintings do reflect his great interest in art and music. But these are giant paintings. I mean, that's probably about the actual size there. They're sort of upwards of 6 or 8 feet tall. So they're huge things. But the interesting thing is that from a distance, they do look like photographs. And then as you move in closer, they sort of disappear on you because they're painted in a very atmospheric sort of way. And while, in a sense, the scale of them might compare to some of Ron Muick's largest sculptures, any resemblance, of course, finishes there because a sculpture, a painting, of course, is an illusion, and you're trying to convert three dimensions into two onto a flat surface. So it's all a big illusion, whereas there is no illusion with sculpture. It's a three-dimensional, it's a solid object, and I mean, what you see is what you get. I mean, and it's exactly the same. You can look up close and from further away. It's just depending on your eyesight, I suppose, but it's exactly the same. There is no sort of optical trickery going on. In Muick's case, there's just this incredible attention to detail. I'm not quite sure whether a Martin Ball portrait really prepares us for Ron Muick, but I can't really think of anything else that does. And as I think I prefaced this talk by, really, Muick's work stands alone. It's really without comparison anywhere, I think. But I'd like to suggest that maybe that gets us thinking about what a portrait is, what you know, the nature of the beast, as it were. And I guess the other message I'd like to convey is that portraiture, the painted portrait in New Zealand is looking very healthy, and I think it's weathered the competition and I think it's in very good heart, and long may it continue. So I think that's really all I've got to say, but thank you. No.